What he did had to have been small potatoes by comparison.
We don't know it was small potatoes. We just don't. There could be a lot of Russian money in that fund. You don't steal from the Russians. I'm Armenian, trust me. I know. They can be seriously badass.
He just didn't seem like the type.
When people need money or love money, they sometimes make very bad decisions, she reminded Cassie. Then, the family published his first full obituary. You can find it online. It's in the Charlottesville Progress. Here are a few things I learned that are not in the obit. Grandfather emigrated here from the Soviet Union when Stalin was still Stalin, 1951. Unsure precisely how. He was a soldier in the Second World War. Self-made man after he got here. Settled in Virginia. Became a lawyer and married a good Southern girl with money. I've already had a private investigator do a little digging. I'm going to have him do a little more.
Can I afford that?
No, but he won't go crazy. I just want to learn a bit about the family and about Alex. See what sorts of interests he might have had.
Business interests?
Yes. It might be helpful to discover precisely what was in the fund. But I was thinking personal interests, too.
Can you tell me more? Cassie asked.
No, but only because there isn't anything more to tell at this point.
What about Miranda?
What about her?
Did you find out anything more about her?
Like, does she really work with Alex, or does she or her family really have money in this magical fund? Asked Ani.
Yes.
Unisphere Asset Management has easily 600 or 700 employees in New York, Washington, Moscow, and Dubai. None of them are named Miranda.
You checked?
My investigator did, yes.
Can he find out if she's an investor?
Maybe, but I'm not confident.
Is it possible she made up the name?
If she killed him? Absolutely, said Ani, her tone decisive. Then, you should call back Frank Hammond. Then call me back. Let's plan on meeting tomorrow, regardless of whether he wants to see you again. Tomorrow was Friday. She had something on Friday. Maybe. She flipped through the calendar in her mind, trying to recall what it was. Then it came to her. Rosemary. Her nephew and niece. She needed to call Rosemary back because her sister and her family were coming to New York. Her sister had said something about the zoo on Saturday, so she guessed she wasn't going to see them tomorrow.
Sure, she told Ani. What time?
Come by my office around 12:15. There's a really good falafel cart around the corner on 53rd Street, and it's supposed to be a beautiful day. Do you like falafel? We could eat al fresco.
That's fine, she said, not really answering the question.
Okay. But call me after you talk to the FBI.
The air marshal on the flight said you and Sokolov were talking a lot. He noticed.
Frank Hammond was saying on the phone.
I don't remember, Cassie said as she opened her suitcase and started unpacking. A part of her knew that she shouldn't be multitasking. All her attention should be on the FBI agent. But the unpacking was calming her.
And the other crew member said he was your guy.
My guy?
Your section.
Yes, that's true.
And you two had a lot of interaction.
I doubt I had any more interaction with him than I did with any other passengers I was serving, she said. It was a lie, but interaction struck her as a vague, ridiculous word that was impossible to quantify. She wondered whether the flight crew was volunteering her name so enthusiastically, or whether it was only the air marshal. She guessed it was also possible that Hammond had phrased his sentence this way because he was bluffing. He was trying to frighten her into believing that he knew more than he did.
You know what I mean, he said. You chatted a lot. It wasn't just about the wine list.
I was polite. He was polite.
You were flirting. He was flirting.
Maybe he flirted with me a little, she said.
But passengers flirt. They're bored. They flirt with all of us when it's a long flight.
Got it. Anyway, that's why I'd like you to come in and chat. I want to see if Sokolov might have said something that can help us help the authorities in Dubai. That's all.
May I bring a lawyer? She asked. She wished instantly that she hadn't inquired. What if he said no? But he didn't. She dropped a dirty blouse into the hamper.
That's your right,
he answered simply. Okay, let me find out when my lawyer is free.
But we want to see you tomorrow.
There wasn't precisely an edge to his voice, but for the first time he hadn't sounded quite so casual, quite so laid back. It suddenly felt a lot less like this was busy work to him. And so she called back Ani, and then she called back the agent. And they agreed to meet the next day at the FBI offices downtown at Broadway and Worth. She said that she'd be there at 2 o'clock sharp. She read the obituary in the newspaper, matching the man recalled in the story with the one who had made love to her in Dubai. Charlottesville. Alexander Peter Sokolov, 32, died July 27, 2018, while traveling for business in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates. He was born March 15, 1986, in Alexandria, Virginia. Alex, as he liked to be called, graduated Pi Beta Kappa from the University of Virginia, double majoring in mathematics and foreign affairs, and then earned a Master of Quantitative Management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. He helped run the Stalwarts Fund for Unisphere Asset Management out of their Manhattan office. He loved his job because he loved data, but he also loved the fact that his work took him often to Russia, the Middle East, and the Far East. He was fearless, whether he was playing his beloved squash or exploring the world. But he was also a kind and generous friend and son. He loved movies and books, especially Russian literature. But most of all, he loved anything surprising and new. He leaves behind a grieving father and mother, Gregory and Harper, as well as an extended family of aunts and uncles and cousins who will miss him dearly. The funeral was the day after tomorrow, Saturday, at a Presbyterian church in Charlottesville. She imagined it crowded with Alex's classmates from the University of Virginia, his childhood friends, and at least some of the employees he worked with at Unisphere. A part of her wanted to go, but she knew that she shouldn't. She wouldn't. The obituary was short and actually revealed very little. In the end, that didn't surprise her either. She stared at the text from Buckley, the actor. He said he had an audition on Friday for a pilot that was going to film in New York in the autumn and had to get a haircut first thing in the morning. He wanted to know what country she was in, but hoped wherever she was dancing barefoot. She recalled how her tale of the dead passenger in the coach bathroom had made him smile. She hadn't answered his last text, but she decided to answer this one. She told him that she had just flown in from Rome. Her feet were killing her, and the last thing she did before strapping in before landing was empty an air sickness bag full of some little boy's pee into the lavatory. She added that the bag wasn't full, because a lot of the urine had wound up on the passengers in the row ahead of the child, and he should take a moment and read the venom about the flight and the airline on Twitter. The hashtag, which already had a life of its own, was hashtag worst flight that didn't crash. It was actually a rather high bar, she thought, when she saw the hashtag gaining momentum. He suggested a late lunch the next day, after his audition, and she wondered what he would have thought if she had texted back that she was seeing her lawyer and then the FBI right about that time. She thought of the way they had parted the previous Sunday morning and sighed. She knew that most men desired her because she was attractive and she was smart, but also because she was a drunk and she was easy. This one, she hoped for his sake he wasn't as different as he seemed, because she always disappointed those men quickly or broke their hearts over time. She texted back that she was busy during the day tomorrow and going to the zoo on Saturday with her nephew and niece. She thought it made her seem wholesome, certainly more wholesome than she was. She suggested dinner tomorrow night, and he agreed. She couldn't imagine what condition she'd be in after a second interview with the FBI and the print edition of the New York Post hitting the stands. She wondered if he would see the image and recognize her. At some point, she'd kicked off her shoes and pulled off her pantyhose, but she honestly couldn't remember when. She had taken the bookend with Romulus and Remus from her suitcase and placed it on the glass coffee table. She couldn't recall doing that either. It must have been when she was on the phone with the FBI. She stretched her toes. Her feet really were killing her. She never had gotten that manicure, and now she needed a pedicure, too. That's what she'd do this August evening. That would be her exciting Thursday night. She'd call neither Paula with her love for Drambuie, nor Jillian with her willingness to pick up the pieces of the messes she left behind. Momentarily, she was struck by the ironically sobering revelation that all of her friends always expected the worst from her. But surrounded as she was by far more troubling and immediate realities, the insight passed. She'd call no one. She'd steer clear of the bars and be level-headed and crisp tomorrow morning when she picked up the New York Post, when she met with Ani and Frank, and when, once more, she had to face the ghost of poor Alex Sokolov. It was after 5 on a Thursday afternoon in the summer, but she reminded herself that people were still working. There might be people in the office. And so that part of her that even sober cavalierly hopscotched across lines most adults had the common sense to respect led her now to the soaring atrium of an office building on the Avenue of the Americas. Here was where Unisphere housed its Manhattan employees, and where, once upon a time, Alex Sokolov had worked. The idea had come to her when she had been stripping off her uniform, planning to change into a casual summer slip of a dress for a mani-pedi and then a quiet evening at home. Instead, she put on a blouse and skirt and pantyhose and took a cab to the building on 49th Street. She simply had to know more than she was learning on the web, especially with another face-to-face meeting with the FBI tomorrow afternoon. She told one of the two uniformed men behind the chest-high marble counter that she had a 5:30 appointment with Alex Sokolov, showed them her driver's license, and signed in. But when they asked her to write her name in the book, she scribbled something that looked more like Alessandra than Cassandra, and a last name that was indecipherable. As she expected, after a few minutes, a slim, statuesque woman in a black blazer emerged from the elevator bank. She had gray eyes and salt-and-pepper hair and introduced herself as Jean Miller from Human Resources. "And your name is Cassandra?" she continued. "Alessandra," Cassie answered. She shrugged. "They sound the same."
"Alessandra what?"
"Richie. Alessandra Richie." The executive motioned toward a marble bench far from the elevators and led Cassie there.
"Let's sit down."
"Is everything all right?" Cassie asked. "I thought at first you were Alex's assistant and were going to escort me upstairs. But you said you're with personnel. Has something happened?" She nodded.
"Yes, something has. I'm so sorry you haven't heard, and I'm so sorry I'm the one who has to tell you."
She took a breath. Then,
"Alex was killed last week in Dubai."
Cassie wrapped her arms around her chest and stared at Jean, hoping that she wasn't overreacting.
"My God! Killed? How?" "Someone stabbed him. Or, I guess, cut his throat. In his hotel room."
"That's horrible. Just awful," she murmured, looking down at her shoes and shaking her head. "Why? Have they caught the person? Or the people?"
No, they haven't. And we don't know why. The motive was probably robbery.
In Dubai? That city's supposed to be so safe.
I guess things can happen anywhere, said Jean.
He was such a sweet guy. Did you know him well?
I knew him better than I did some of the other managers.
How come?
He was from Virginia. I'm from North Carolina. Not a lot of Southerners in this office. So even though our paths weren't likely to cross all that often for work, we sometimes had coffee. Sometimes we chatted. Visited, as we might say in the South.
Cassie almost said that she was from Kentucky. A reflex. She stopped herself just in time. Instead, she said, He introduced me to Russian literature. I hadn't read Tolstoy, not even in college, until we met. Jean smiled.
He was weirdly bookish.
Weirdly?
The sort of man who runs a hedge fund isn't usually the sort of man we think of curled up with a book.
What books did he talk to you about?
Oh, you know.
Cassie waited, hoping Jean would elaborate, but she didn't. When she remained silent, Cassie said finally, He loved Tolstoy and Pushkin. Turgenev. We talked about whatever he was taking with him to read on airplanes all the time.
I'm glad you two shared that.
He had a girlfriend in Dubai. A friend, who was a girl. Her name was Miranda. Any idea who that might be? He ever mention her when you two would visit?
Why?
He told me he was going to have dinner with her when he was there. He was looking forward to it. They were just friends, but he was hoping it would become something more. He had a crush on her. You said you knew him a bit. Did he ever talk about her? Miranda? Jean looked at her a little more intensely now.
What's her last name?
I don't know.
I don't either, she said, but I'll be sure and tell the police about her. The FBI, actually. I think you need to speak to them, too.
Yes, of course, absolutely.
Tell me, why were you supposed to meet with Alex today? His assistant had nothing on his calendar this afternoon. He wasn't even supposed to be in America today. I asked her on my way downstairs.
Was he supposed to be in Dubai still?
Moscow.
He traveled a lot.
He did. Was your meeting today a personal thing, Alessandra? Is that why he didn't tell his assistant?
She shrugged. We're friends, yes. We were friends. Sorry. But I was also a client of his. Of yours. She recalled his obituary. I'm invested in the Stalwarts Fund. Jean seemed to take this in, absorbing the information. Cassie considered the possibility that she simply didn't look wealthy enough to be an investor. But then Jean said, shaking her head ever so slightly,
That is such an old boy fund. Such an old man fund. Why did you invest in it?
Alex recommended it.
She sighed. I thought we'd called every one of his clients to tell them what had happened to poor Alex.
Maybe I have a voicemail I missed.
Maybe. But we were persistent, Jean said, and for the first time she sounded slightly dubious. I really was under the impression that we'd spoken with everyone. Everyone.
I appreciate that.
Would you like me to schedule a meeting for next week with someone about your account? Or a phone call tomorrow?
She pulled a phone from her blazer pocket and opened a calendar app.
We can do this right now.
Yes, certainly. Who would that be?
We have a couple of managers who are diving in. You tell me what's convenient for you.
Okay, she agreed, and she suggested any time on Tuesday or Wednesday afternoon, and then offered a fake phone number and a fake email address. When Jean stood, Cassie stood with her and exited back into the summer heat, aware that the executive probably was memorizing every detail about her that she could. She guessed the woman would be on the phone with the FBI before she had even crossed the street. As she walked south, she inventoried in her mind the little she had learned. Alex was going to Moscow from Dubai, and he had never mentioned a person named Miranda to this other Unisphere employee. He ran a fund that, at least in the opinion of this woman from personnel, had a select group of investors, old boys. She couldn't fully translate what that meant, but she had a sense it meant Russian. Old Russians. In her mind, she saw a portrait of the Politburo, circa 1967. A lot of bald white guys with bad haircuts. It wasn't much, but it was something, and she was glad she had gone there. It was while crossing Fifth Avenue near the library that she felt it. A prickle of unease along her skin, a shiver along the back of her neck. She knew the word from a psychology course she'd taken in college. Scopesthesia. The idea was you could sense when you were being watched. It was a cousin of scopophobia, the fear of being watched. She had the exact feeling now that she had experienced the other day when she had fled from the subway. She looked to her right and saw there in the other crosswalk, also walking east, a fellow in shades and a black ball cap. It wasn't an uncommon look, not at all. But hadn't the guy watching her on the subway platform, maybe watching her on the subway platform, been wearing a similar cap and similar shades? Of course he had. She tried to catch his hair color, but couldn't. She tried to guess his age, but she couldn't guess that either. He could be 20, and he could be 50. She continued walking and considered whether to confront him. If any place was going to be safe for this sort of engagement, it would be late on a summer afternoon in Midtown Manhattan. She tried to imagine his response, and presumed the sort of denial she'd get from an FBI agent would be different from the kind she'd hear from a what? An assassin? The person who'd killed Alex Sokolov? She stopped at the corner of Madison, planning to cross the street to his side. At the very least, she would get close enough to see who he was. The idea that this might not be an FBI agent had given her pause, and she was less confident now that she would actually ask him why he was following her. But she had been emboldened by her visit to Unisphere. She'd gone there and was a little wiser now. Nothing cataclysmic had occurred. But when she reached the far side of the street, he was gone. If he had ever really been there at all.
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD-302. Jada Morris, flight attendant. Date, August 2nd, 2018. Jada Morris, date of birth. Social Security number, telephone number, was interviewed for a second time by properly identified special agents Amara Lindor and John Newhouse at the FBI office in Melville, New York. Lindor conducted the interview. Newhouse took these notes. Morris said she was confident that the woman in the two security camera photos from the Royal Phoenician Hotel was Cassandra Bowden. She said she only learned that Bowden's brother-in-law had something to do with chemical weapons on the morning of July 27th, when the discussion among the cabin crew in the airline shuttle van in Dubai gravitated there. She reiterated that she had met Alex Sokolov for the first time on July 26th, on the flight between Paris and Dubai. Morris said she had bid on Moscow four times in the last year and gotten the city twice, simply because she had never been to Russia. She claims to know no one there. Her trip to Dubai on July 26th through 27th was her fourth visit that month with the airline, but this July marked the first time she had gotten the bid. She was able to account for her whereabouts the full time, including her dinner on Thursday night, July 26th, at the Kagaya Japanese restaurant with three other flight attendants. She said she has lost touch with Eliza Redman Huff, her classmate from Michigan State University, who married drone pilot Captain Devin Huff. She said she knows almost nothing about what her cousin, engineer Isaiah Bell, does with stealth technology at Welkin Aerospace Systems in Nashua, New Hampshire. She claimed never to have heard of United Arab Emirates drone designer Novaskies.
Chapter 13. The Dubai restaurant faced the harbor and had floor-to-ceiling casement windows, open now to catch the morning breeze off the Gulf. There were white linen tablecloths that were pristine, as were the white leather banquettes on which the guests were sitting. It was part of a hotel with a marina. The buffet of pastries and cheeses and exotic fruits and vegetables was presented on white serving plates on white marble counters that were streaked and dotted with black. They looked to Elena like giant squares of stracciatella gelato. She and Victor had shared a yogurt and a purslane salad, but now he was waiting on the fried eggs and Turkish sausage he had ordered in addition. He had insisted they have breakfast before she followed the flight attendant back to America. "They tell me the flash drive was worthless," he said to her. "Nothing of value. Nothing Novaskies can't already do and nothing to help with a new sort of payload." He wasn't precisely chastising her, but there was more than mere disappointment in his tone. A thought passed through her mind, but she told herself that she was being paranoid and she should not allow it to take root. Did Victor suspect that she had tampered with the flash drive Sokolov had been given? Did he believe that she had deleted the information they were expecting? "Really? Nothing?" she asked. "Nothing." "I'm sorry," she said quietly. "We expected more." He looked around and she saw why. The hostess was about to seat a couple of Western businessmen at the table beside them. Instantly he stood and asked the woman in Arabic if she could please seat them a little further away. He was discussing deeply personal family matters with his daughter and would be grateful for the extra privacy. The young woman, Indian or Pakistani, Elena presumed, smiled and obliged. The businessman didn't seem to care. "Now I'm your daughter?" she asked Victor when he sat back down. He shrugged. "I would be proud to have you as my daughter." She didn't believe him and rolled her eyes. He and her father had endured each other, little more. She knew in the end what Victor had done to him. "Even after this fiasco?" "Even after, yes. Even the most successful people in this world make mistakes. Often, they're just better at correcting them and moving on." His eggs and sausages arrived, and he smiled happily at the waitress. After she had placed them before him and retreated, he continued, "Our job is to anticipate, and in this case you anticipated wrong. Now you are responding accordingly." "Yes, of course." He motioned at his plate. "God, the stuff is good. You really should try some." Despite his apparent enthusiasm for the entree before him, however, almost delicately he sliced off a thin section of one of the sausages. He brought the piece to his mouth, chewed, and smiled a little too rapturously for Elena's taste. If breakfast could make him this happy, she shuddered to think of what he might be like in bed. "I spoke to the police," he said when he had finished chewing. "They interviewed most of us." "And?" "It was fine. None of us are American women, but it could have been awkward. Another reason why you should have told me right away about the flight attendant."
"I understand."
"I'm sure you do."
"How much time do I have?" she asked.
"How much time do we have?" he corrected her. "Don't feel so alone out there."
"I am so alone out there."
"The woman is either a wild card or something far worse."
"A wild card," she repeated, mulling that over.
She considered pressing him about what he meant by something far worse, but she recalled his remark about the worthless flash drive. If he really didn't trust her, if he actually doubted her, the last thing she wanted to do was inadvertently force him to say such a thing aloud. Verbalizing it would make it too real, the accusation irrevocable. "Yes, a wild card. She's a drunk and, I have come to believe, a little self-destructive."
"You mean in addition to her drinking?"
He put down his fork and looked at her intensely. "I'm not sure what I mean. I just know that I want her gone. It shouldn't be difficult.
Probably not, Elena said, though she didn't completely agree. It wouldn't be difficult operationally, but it sure as hell would piss people off, and it sure as hell would exact a high price on her soul. Killing Bowden wouldn't be like killing Sokolov, an opportunistic fuck who'd agreed to mule American data because he knew he was in deep shit for skimming and had now served his purpose. He clearly couldn't be trusted. Nor would it be like killing that despicable colonel at Ernkelik who was playing both sides and getting rich. That prick had just screwed some poor Yazidi girl who couldn't have been more than 14 or 15 years old when she shot him. He was a pig, but this flight attendant? Not her usual quarry. It would be like drowning a kitten. But Elena was in survival mode herself, and so she added, "It's mostly the travel that annoys me."
"You really don't like to travel?"
"I was looking forward to spending a little time here. Or going home to Sochi for a bit." He seemed to relax a little bit. He picked up his fork and gazed down at his breakfast. "You will. All in good time. This is a speed bump, that's all. No, it's a detour. A detour to America. You like America," he said. The last sentence a small, slight dig. "But then you'll come back. Or go home. Whichever you want."
"Okay."
He looked over her shoulder and pointed. She turned and saw a pair of mynah birds on an outside railing just behind her, their yellow beaks phosphorescent in the sun.
"Even the birds here eavesdrop," he said, smiling.
But then his tone grew serious. "You asked me how much time you have," he said. "The fact the flash drive was of no value, no use, doesn't reflect well on you. You should know that no one is happy about that."
"I am just being honest, so I think you should move quickly. For your own sake, Elena. For your own good.
Soon would be best. For everyone."
Chapter 14. Cassie saw that she was on page 9 of the New York Post and page 11 of the Daily News. At the same time that she bought the two newspapers at the Rite Aid a block from her apartment, she bought new sunglasses, big and bulky and a completely different shape from her old ones, the ones in the photograph. On her way back to her building, she threw away the sunglasses she was wearing in Dubai, as well as the scarf with the arabesque patterns. It was pretty, and she knew she would miss it. She deposited them into an overflowing trash can on the corner because the garbage would be collected later that morning. The article was identical to the version she had read online, and she was rather surprised by how tame it all seemed now that she had read Sokolov's obituary. Usually the Post wrote the worst or the wildest things that anyone thought or suspected, but would never say aloud. But there was no conjecture that Alex was CIA or KGB. No innuendo at all that he was a spy. Alex was portrayed as just another hedge fund guy who happened to go to places like Moscow and Dubai for work. On the sidewalk near her apartment, she saw three schoolgirls walking toward her in matching plaid uniform skirts and white blouses, and guessed they were close to her nephew's age. They looked about 11. Each was using her phone as a compact, flipping the camera lens as if taking a selfie. But she could tell by the anxiety in all of their eyes that they weren't merely checking their makeup. Were they wearing anything more than lipstick? But were instead examining their faces for uncorrectable imperfections. One of the girls had twin constellations of freckles on her cheeks. Another, who looked closest to tears, had a slight bump along the ridge of her nose. They were pretty girls, and their self-doubt and their fear seemed needless. But Cassie understood. She had no idea where they were going because she doubted even private school started this early in August. Perhaps it was some sort of summer program or summer day trip. It didn't matter. She recalled feeling the way they did herself. She knew her niece would soon. All of Jessica's confidence would disappear like a helium balloon released on a blustery autumn afternoon. Maybe some of it would return, but it would never be as bold and pure as it once was. When the children were behind her, Cassie looked again at the picture of herself in the tabloid. Utterly disgusted, she shook her head, exactly like the girl with the freckles. Almost as soon as she was back in her apartment, her phone rang and she saw it was Megan. She paused for a brief moment, but then answered it. "Hey there," she said. "Aren't you in Berlin?"
"I am. The flight's delayed, so I thought I'd check in with you. You okay?"
"Let's see. I'm speaking again to the FBI this afternoon, and I'm kind of wigged out by the newspapers. Other than that, what could possibly be wrong?"
"I get it. The FBI talked to me again, too."
She stared at Hammond's business card on her refrigerator. Suddenly, she felt as if she had just dodged a bullet, not saying anything more to Megan. She told herself that she was being crazy, but an idea came to her. This conversation is being recorded. The FBI was using Megan to get her to incriminate herself. And so, just in case, she responded, "I hope they get to the bottom of this soon. I feel so bad for that poor man's family." She said a small prayer that Megan wouldn't bring up the fact that she had asked her friend to lie for her when they had spoken last. "Vaughn feels that way, too," Megan agreed, referring to her husband. "When he read the newspaper stories, he called and said he didn't understand why it's all about the mystery woman and not the guy who was killed."
"How is Vaughn?"
"Good. Same old, same old."
"What's he working on these days?" she asked.
She had no interest at all in what Vaughn Briscoe did for a living as a consultant, but the question struck her as innocuous and safe. She felt bad not trusting her friend, but just in case, she had to get this conversation as far from Dubai as she could.
"More government nonsense. He's in Edgewater, Maryland again. He's happier when he's with private sector clients, but it makes our life so much easier when he's working in Maryland or inside the Beltway. When the girls were younger and he was working for that pharmaceutical company in Colorado, child care was a nightmare. He was always away, always traveling. Kind of like me. Now he's home every night, and this fall he'll be able to pick them up from the 10 trillion places they have to be after school when I can't."
"How was Berlin?"
"It was fine. Are you nervous about this afternoon?"
"No,"
Cassie lied. "How many times and how many ways can they ask me about what Sokolov was like on the flight, or whether he said anything of interest?"
"That's all they're asking?"
"So far. Maybe they'll have more interesting questions for me this afternoon."
"Look, Cassie..."
"Go on."
"Do you need anything? Is there anything I can do?"
"Like what?"
"I don't know. I just feel so bad for you. I just..."
"I'm fine," Cassie said. She wanted to cut her friend off before she could say something they both might regret. "I need to run. My family's coming to town from Kentucky this weekend, and I have 1,000 things to do. But I really appreciate the offer, and I love hearing your voice. I love it. But I'm okay."
"If you change your mind, you know where to find me."
"Yeah. Berlin," she answered, and she laughed ever so slightly. Her friend, if she needed her, probably would be on another continent and in a time zone 6 hours distant. To try and take her mind off the newspapers and what loomed that afternoon, she finished "The Death of Ivan Ilyich" on the couch, occasionally glancing up at the Empire State Building when her mind wandered from 19th century Russia. She felt neither virtuous for reading Tolstoy, nor relieved by Ilyich's transformation. The way he went from fearing to welcoming that great, ineludible light. Mostly, she continued to hope that Alex Sokolov hadn't woke up when his throat was being cut. It was hot and sunny again that Friday, and so Ani directed Cassie to a glass table in a shady spot of the courtyard, and the two of them brought their street falafel there.
The city felt quiet to Cassie, even for the start of a weekend in the middle of the summer. This building isn't precisely a ghost town on August Fridays, but a lot of people clear out, especially the businesses on the other floors. Don't even try and schedule a meeting after lunch on a Friday in August, she told Cassie. We're getting so Parisian in the 212, Cassie murmured. She was distracted. She hadn't fallen asleep until, almost in desperation near midnight, she had done a couple shots of vodka, popped a pair of Advil PMs, and swallowed a few tabs of melatonin. Normally, she didn't need melatonin on this side of the Atlantic, but normally she wasn't meeting with lawyers and then the FBI. She'd been fine, a little fuzzy maybe, but fine, when she had first crawled out of bed and walked to the Rite Aid for the newspapers. Ani smiled at her small joke, but Cassie could see concern in her eyes. You look tired, she said. I am. She stared at the falafel and sauce in its pita, the wrap in its wax paper. She had no appetite today and tried to decide if she was any less hungry than usual. Are you going to be okay? I think so. Ani wiped her fingers on her napkin and reached over and took Cassie's hands. Try not to worry. You're not in Dubai. No one is going to prosecute you for committing an act that may lure a person to sin. That's a thing in the Emirates? It is. So is having consensual sex outside of wedlock. She looked down at her hands and Ani's. Her skin was so pale compared to the lawyer's. It was August. Why hadn't she been to the beach? Or a lake? Or even, for God's sake, a tanning salon and gotten sprayed? She took back her hands, hoping Ani wouldn't think it was an unfriendly gesture. We should eat, she added quickly, trying to give a concrete reason for her discomfort with Ani's kindness, with her touch. Yes, the lawyer agreed. I went by Unisphere yesterday, after you and I spoke. You what? I wanted to learn more about Alex, she said, aware of how sheepish she sounded. Had you been drinking? No. I think I should be a little insulted you even asked that. God. Tell me precisely what happened, Ani commanded. And so Cassie did, sharing her exchange with a woman from personnel and the little she'd gleaned from the encounter. They're going to know it's you, if they don't already, the lawyer said when she'd finished. I suspected as much, but I had to try. Please promise me that you won't do that sort of thing again. I promise, she agreed. Did you find out anything more about Alex at your end? She asked. No, but I called my investigator friend again last night, Ani said. Did you read Alex's obituary? I did. And? I don't know. Doesn't it scream spy to you? Ani took a small bite of the wrap and seemed to think carefully before answering. It doesn't scream that. Maybe it hints at that. I picked up on how brief it was. And the cities. Lots of people work in Moscow and Dubai who have nothing to do with espionage. When will the investigator know something? Next week, Ani answered. Maybe even early next week. Okay. Now, this afternoon, the case agent, this Frank Hammond, is going to be sneaky. It's possible you're going to think he's a freaking dunce, but he's not, I assure you. An FBI knife goes in very slowly. FBI agents are trained to get someone to unwittingly tell the truth. Also, I'm sure he knows a lot more than the newspapers do. He knows everything the FBI's legal attaché in the Emirates knows, and they're 8 hours ahead of us. There were probably developments today that we know absolutely nothing about. God. Don't feel that way. A lot depends on whether the Emirates feels like playing ball with the U.S. They may not. It's their country. And while they might be worried about some kind of tourism backlash, The rest of the Muslim Middle East is a hell of a lot scarier to most Americans than Dubai. Besides, it's not like there's a pattern of violent crime against tourists there. The truth is, there's really no reason why Dubai will care all that much about the murder of some money manager in their fair city. Unless they actually want to make it clear that he was killed by another American, a drunk flight attendant from New York. I guess. But assuming he was just some MBA with Unisphere Asset Management, I really can't understand why the FBI would give a damn. And yet it's clear that they do. Do you believe they're still looking for an American woman who lives in Dubai? Nope. No? She heard the fear in her voice. I mean, I don't know that for a fact. But by now they've talked to the people Alex knew or might have known. Everyone who was supposed to be in that meeting, everyone with Unisphere, everyone at the hotel. They're working their way backward. By now, every American woman he spoke with on that flight from Paris to Dubai, especially the flight attendant, is under suspicion. I see. Ani put down her wrap and took a breath. Now, this meeting with the FBI isn't precisely a situation where you can perjure yourself. This isn't a sworn deposition. But they will try and catch you in a lie, and it is a federal offense to lie to an FBI agent. You may not even feel the knife going in until they begin to twist it. I had been planning to lie like crazy when we landed, but they never asked me anything that demanded a lie. That's good. So what am I supposed to do? Well, first of all, don't lie. Just don't. But you can take the Fifth Amendment. Do you know what that is? Yes. But then, of course, I sound like a mafia wife. That is the problem with the Fifth. The FBI may still be fishing. They might, in fact, have nothing concrete. And if you take the Fifth, that's a pretty serious nibble. So, I want you to look at me before you answer any question. If I nod, tell the truth. If I shake my head, take the Fifth. Cassie watched a plane flying silently high overhead. Even now, despite her years at 35,000 feet, the miracle of flight continued to move her. Won't you be sitting next to me? Probably, but I don't care if they see me coaching you. That doesn't matter. Good God, if necessary, I will jump in for you and say you're taking the Fifth. The thing is... Ani's voice trailed off. Go on. I wanted to tell you this in person. You may not be extraditable for murder, but you aren't out of the woods. There are other reasons why you could be prosecuted in the U.S. for Sokolov's death. Terrorism, for instance. What? It's unlikely, but here's the chain. The Department of Justice and the OVT, the Office of Justice for Victims of Overseas Terrorism, the OVT reports to National Security. The OVT director meets weekly with the folks in counterterrorism and counter-espionage. Alex Sokolov is an American citizen who was murdered abroad, and his death could be handed over to them, especially if he was someone important to the government. That's absurd. Once in a while, I may drink too much, but I'm not a terrorist. I get it. I just want to be sure you understand the stakes before we go downtown. Now, you should eat. You really should. If you don't like falafel, don't be polite. Tell me. We'll find you something else. I want to coach you for a few minutes, and I want to be sure you have some sustenance inside you before we meet with the FBI. She nodded and started to eat, and tried to pay attention. Suddenly, she was feeling like a victim herself, and that only made her feel worse. It shamed her to feel that way. After all, she wasn't the body left behind in the bed. Cassie rarely got to Wall Street, but when she did, she was always struck by how narrow the streets were compared to Murray Hill and Midtown Manhattan. The FBI was in a skyscraper on Broadway, but Broadway this far downtown, this close to the Brooklyn Bridge, was the slender tip of the funnel. Federal Plaza was a little more squat than the Seagram building, but what made it feel so different was the Wall Street claustrophobia induced by the combination of tall edifices and thin streets. Outside the building was a small park with three tall, dark columns, a sculpture called the Sentinel, and some trees that she guessed were a kind of willow. On the side streets around the plaza were manned guardhouses and black and yellow striped metal barricades that police officers raised or lowered to allow select vehicles in and out of the parking garage. She thought of the fearless girl standing tall against the bull a few blocks to the south. Cassie understood that there was nothing heroic about who she was, nothing courageous about what she was doing. She was here because she drank too much, and a decade and a half of bad decisions, especially one night in Dubai, was catching up to her. But she thought of that bronze little girl with a ponytail, her hands on her hips, and her chest out, facing off against the much larger bull. Cassie wanted now to be just that plucky and do the right thing. Whatever that was. "Ready?" Ani asked. They hadn't spoken since they had gotten out of the cab a minute ago and paused in front of the Sentinel. Cassie shook her head. "No, but I really don't have a choice now, do I?" Ani looked her in the eye. "You'll be fine. Just remember, whatever you do, don't lie." The room was windowless, and Cassie didn't care. She was struck by the shiny, fake veneer of the rectangular table and how the chairs were covered in an orange shade of naga hide that belonged only on pumpkins. Once again, Frank Hammond was interviewing her, and James Washburn was taking the notes.
"Glad you could make it this afternoon," Hammond said after Cassie had introduced Ani to the two agents and everyone was seated. "I really am grateful. I know it's an inconvenience, but we want to help the Emirates and put this part of the investigation to bed. We want to move on."
"Of course," she agreed.
"I just hate to have busy work hanging over my head over the weekend, especially a summer weekend."
"It's fine." He smiled. She was struck once more by how world-weary he seemed for a guy who couldn't have been more than 40 or 41. Once again, she noted Washburn's unblemished skin and rimless eyeglasses, and wondered if he was ever allowed outside.
"When do you fly out again?"
he asked. "Sunday."
"Back to Dubai?"
"Rome. I have Rome this month."
"I love Italy."
"I do too." He shook his head wistfully, and she presumed he was recalling a moment in a beautiful piazza in a Tuscan village, or a perfect endless meal in Florence.
"Of course, I've never been there, but I hope to get there someday," he said. "So, I guess I really just love the idea of Italy."
For a moment she was taken aback, but quickly she gathered herself. "I hope you get there too," she said. "It's beautiful. It lives up to its reputation. It's one of the prettiest places in the world, I think."
"And you've seen a lot of the world?"
"I guess."
"Is that why you became a flight attendant? You love to travel?"
She shrugged, unsure whether this was chatter to wear down her reserve, or he needed to know for some reason. Washburn's gaze was moving between her and the pad on the table in front of him, but he wasn't writing anything down. "I think so," she answered simply. She remembered her carefully scripted answer during her job interview with the airline 18 years ago. "I enjoy people. I think customer service is a real art."
"Ever consider becoming a pilot?"
"Nope."
"How come?"
"Not really my skill set. I kind of think you don't want a person like me ever driving a cab or a school bus." She'd meant it as a joke, but she saw Ani's eyes grow a little wide, and she realized that humor, or at least humor that acknowledged her more irresponsible tendencies, was a particularly bad idea.
"Oh? Why is that?"
I just meant that I live in the city. I don't even own a car.
Hammond nodded, and Washburn started to write.
So, we're just clearing up a few little things as a courtesy to Dubai, the case agent said. This shouldn't take very long at all. You said that you and Alex Sokolov spoke during the food service on that last flight, the one from Paris to Dubai on July 26th.
That's correct?
You said he was a flirt.
Kind of.
How? What kinds of things did he say?
He said he liked our uniforms. We actually have three kinds, a pantsuit, a skirt and a blouse, and a dress. I usually wear the dress.
Why?
It's the most flattering on me.
That's interesting.
Why?
I don't know. I guess I'd wear the one that was most comfortable.
That's because you're male.
He chuckled and nodded.
Probably true.
But to be honest, they're all pretty comfortable. He seemed to think about this. Then,
what else did he say?
Alex Sokolov? I don't remember. I've had...
And Cassie paused to count in her mind. 4 flights since then.
The air marshal recalls you two talking a lot.
I don't know about that. I tried to do a good job, and part of that is making passengers feel relaxed and happy on a flight.
He tell you anything about himself?
Not really. He probably didn't tell me much at all.
You said he told you that he was a money manager. What else?
I can't think of anything.
You two both talked about living in Manhattan, yes?
Yes.
Another passenger recalled him telling you that he was an only child. You told him you had a sister. Do you remember that?
Not really.
Some other family stuff, maybe?
He asked.
Someone else said you two talked about Kentucky, how your sister and her family still live there.
She glanced at Ani, and then at the way that Washburn had suddenly, inconceivably, filled almost an entire sheet of paper on the yellow legal pad.
I don't know. It's possible.
Did he tell you about why he was in Dubai? His work?
I don't remember him saying much about that.
Okay. He said he was a money manager. What else?
He said he ran a hedge fund.
Good. Go on.
That's all. I don't even know what a hedge fund is, precisely, she admitted.
What meetings did he mention?
I know he had a meeting, but we didn't discuss it.
It was supposed to be the next day?
Yes.
Who was going to be in it?
Investors, I suppose.
So these were investors in Dubai?
He asked. I'm just speculating.
Any names?
Instantly, she recalled Miranda and almost offered that name. But as far as the FBI knew, she hadn't seen Alex once he exited the jet bridge in Dubai. She considered telling Hammond that he brought the woman up on the plane, but she wasn't sure she would be able to manage the questions, the fallout, that would emerge from the revelation. And so she answered, "Not that he told me on the plane."
Okay. What about friends? Did he say anything about any acquaintances or buddies or women he might have been planning to see while he was in the Emirates?
No, he didn't mention anyone.
I don't think we asked this when you landed. I'm so sorry. Did you see Sokolov in Dubai?
She thought of how Ani had warned her that she might not feel the knife going in, but she knew she would. Here it was. The question, the third in a string of short sentences, was the blade at the edge of her skin. Did you see Sokolov in Dubai? She also recalled how Ani had said that under no circumstances should she lie. It was better to take the 5th. And so she took a deep breath, and she did. On my counsel's advice, I am invoking my right under the 5th Amendment not to answer. It took courage to say those words. Not fearless girl bravery, not a righteous refusal to be bullied, but it was still a kind of valor she wasn't sure she had. She wanted to lie.
It was just easier to lie. So much of her life was lying. Oh, she would have moments of candor, especially when she was forced to face who she was after a particularly deep drunk, or when the postcoital revulsion